Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This is Histories of the Unexpected.
He's the famous historical adventurer Dr. Sam Willis.
And he is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. He is Professor James Daybell.
And we are your hosts for Histories of the Unexpected.
Each week we discuss a surprising subject oozing with unexpected historical significance. And this week it's the paperclip,
which is all about the Stasi. It's about Big Brother and spying on people. Oh yes, and puzzle women.
What?
Puzzle women.
Well, for me, it's about the Norwegian resistance movement in the Second World War. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, and tell all of your friends. Do it now. Go on. We're on Twitter. Follow me at Dr. Sam Willis.
And you can follow me at James Daybell. And you can follow the Histories of the Unexpected podcast on at Unexpected Podcast, spelled PDCST. We are proud to be part of the excellent History Hit Network, home of Dan Snow's History Hit and other great shows coming soon.
And you can find out more about what we've got planned in the forthcoming months. Show notes, video clips, photos of everything we discuss and much, much more at historyhit.com/unexpected. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 30 of Histories of the Unexpected, where we will be audio googling through history, exploring the histories of things that you didn't even know had a significant story to tell, like monsters, the chair, or the knife.
And we'll be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how simply everything has a history, and crucially, how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, that the history of the glove, was in fact all about poisoning at the court of Queen Elizabeth, and that the history of sweat was all to do with slums in New York. It's about sweatshops, cramped conditions.
The man sitting opposite me is the jester of journals. It's Professor James Daybell.
Hello, and the man sitting opposite me is the custodian of conundrums. It is Dr. Sam Willis.
I'd be a very bad custodian. I just want to put that out there. I lose stuff all the time. Together, we will be piloting you on this uncharted and frankly highly dangerous flight into the past. Each week, one of us takes the lead with a new idea, a new theme. This week, it's your turn.
Okay, I have for you the paperclip. And this is in honour of those very nice people at BBC Radio Devon and the afternoon show who had me on to talk about this podcast series when we first launched. The very nice people in PR at Plymouth University put together a press pack and they bit about the paperclip.
Right.
They were obsessed with the paperclip.
That's interesting.
And they wanted me to talk about nothing but the paperclip. So I would talk about anything else other than the paperclip. But this is specially for BBC Radio Devon.
Is that because you think they didn't believe that the paperclip has a history?
Exactly.
I think so, because it was probably a list of things like demons and monsters and zombies, which
yes,
people might assume have a history, but paperclip.
And I think they just assumed that being a history professor, I was, you know, just an out-and-out nerd, you know, the history of the train timetable.
So it actually is the history of the paperclip. Right, yes. Okay, so we're doing the paperclip.
So where do you go with the paperclip? I have one for you here.
All right, let me have one, and then it might inspire
me. This will inspire you. This is a gem paperclip.
Oh, that's beautiful. It's a very tiny one.
Isn't it lovely?
It's much smaller. They come in different sizes, don't they? So, for me, the immediate thought is that it's to do with the history of innovation and being able to record that innovation and sort of entrepreneurs making immense fortunes out of something ridiculously simple, but which is, you know, just prevalent in society. I mean, I wonder how many paperclips I've got in my house. I've probably got 100 and I don't think I've got any. They're probably everywhere.
I have a pot of 5,000 here.
And you've got different sizes?
Yes.
5,000.
That's because they're mixed up. I bought a box of 5,000. I use them all the time. In fact, all the notes that I keep for this podcast series are kept with paperclips. Mm. So for me, it's about filing.
Okay, so you can go to the logistical side of things. But so for me, it's patents. It's to do with the legal side of things and how you can actually prove that invention is yours, you can guarantee that you get paid for that invention. It's to do with capitalism, I suppose, isn't it?
If you follow the early office museum blog site, you will see a very good
history of the early office museum. The early office.
Exactly, which is all about stationery. And they have a wonderful webpage, which is about the history of the paperclip. And if you go to that webpage, you can see any number of different sort of styles of paperclips, which I've got here in front of me. So the gem is the one that I gave you. Well, have a look at this one of the earlier ones
just
here.
Just struck me. Offices, right? So they're all to do with massive, large-scale administration.
Yeah.
And so what is the one example of the biggest scale sort of pre-industrial administrative system in the UK? The Navy.
The Navy, yep.
See, where it's the Navy. And actually, the history of offices and the history of administration is all to do with the Navy, particularly in the 17th century. Samuel Pepys, people like that, who suddenly reformed everything.
Pepys, the great diarist,
I bet, yeah. So that was all to do with that. So maybe there is a route into my deep knowledge here.
I discovered some Samuel Pepys letters, unpublished Samuel Pepys letters, in Devon Record Office.
Cool.
The Devon Heritage Centre. Cool. Very, very short. He's losing his eyesight at that period, but it's 1670s, I think.
Did really they have paperclips in the 1670s?
No paperclips. So if we think about the history of the paperclip and linking to your patents, is around mid-19th century. So one Samuel B. Fay in 1867, an American, licensed a paperclip. And there are other sort of paperclips, you know, after that in 1904, Cushman and Denison. There's also a sort of a tale that the Norwegians invented the paperclip. And there's a Norwegian inventor.
Johan Vaalier.
That's exactly him, who patented it in, I think, in Germany and in America. And so that's the early story of it. But what I'm going to do now is talk about a period pre the paperclip. I want to start by showing you some pictures, some famous portraits. What we have here is a 16th century merchant, portrait of a merchant, 1530, the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., by Jan Grossart. And what you can see here, well, you describe it.
So you've got the merchant here, and he's sitting at his desk, and he's got a sheaf of papers, he's got a quill, he's got an ink pot, he's writing, he's got more quills to the right of him, so it's quite a busy desk.
Yeah.
And then up behind him, he's got loads of sheaves of paper, kind of, well, they're hanging from the wall.
They're hanging
from the wall, but they look like a modern calendar, like you get a calendar for Christmas. And
so this is a period pre the paperclip.
And pre-filing.
And this is what he's doing. Well, it's pre-filing cabinets, but this is his makeshift filing system. So these are obviously the bills and the correspondence that he's got pinned in some sort of systematic order. We have another quite famous painting here from Hans Holbein the Younger, another early 16th century, the portrait of the merchant George Guise.
It shares a lot with the other one, doesn't it? So you've got a merchant there at his desk. He's got, a very busy table with all sorts of things. Got a nice vase of flowers. Everyone should have a vase of flowers on their desk. An extraordinary array of things sort of tucked up on shelves behind him. This is brilliant. We should do the history of the study.
Yeah. I would be obsessed with that. I've got all sorts of inventories that document exactly what's in the study. Yes,
He's got his letters sort of hooked over bars, isn't he?
So what I want to talk about is a period pre the paperclip. So we're talking about the emergence of paper documents, basically, which you can document from the medieval period onwards. But the 16th century is a real time of explosion in terms of the very records that we've got.
What were they writing on before paper then?
Romans, so they'd be writing on tablets, they'd be writing on, you know, on vellum.
Walls, we've done graffiti.
On walls, we've done graffiti. But we've got, you know, the need to basically systematise paperwork. So it's about how you impose administrative structures onto society through the use of paper with the rise of literacy. And what you've got here is two merchants who are obviously dealing with masses of paper all the time. You know, they've got correspondence coming in, they've got bills, they've got accounts, they've got all sorts of things that they need to keep. And there are some really interesting ways. I must admit, I am slightly obsessed about stationery. This is a continual theme. And about archives. Yeah. I just happen to be writing a book on archives at the moment. So that's where this is coming from. But what we've got is these really interesting techniques pre the paperclip to actually stick bits of paper together. You know, and there are records of people stringing correspondence literally on a string.
Really?
As a way of sort of plucking it down. And you can see in the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., there are examples of various documents with little pinholes in them.
Yeah.
And the pinholes is not just people poking pins in, it's where the string would have gone through,
strung up
to organise it.
So it reminds me of Christmas cards kind of dangled up now.
Exactly.
I think actually the important thing is with administrative systems like that is us being able to draw it out and saying, once you are dealing with massive, massive bodies of paperwork and you work out a system which enables you to process that, then things like governments, things like armies, things like navies, things like tax, that all becomes much, much more efficient. So it's actually to do with the establishment and the growth of society as we know isn't it?
Yeah, and archives extend not only state archives, any institution will have an archive. So you can think about schools, you can think about hospitals, you can think about corporations, families have archives and ways of, you know, of recording family memory, of keeping track of land, inheritance.
That's interesting. So there's a difference between working documents, like at the moment we have our notes in front of us now, which are working documents, where how we store those once they have been used.
I have paper clips and folders and a filing box. Mm-hmm. But where I want to go with this is an example of Lord Burghley, you know, who's one of the leading government officials in the reign of Elizabeth I. And this was a man who just dominated the political scene from Elizabeth's accession to the end of his life in the late 1590s. And this was a man who kept a team of private secretaries to work for him. And because he was politically so important, had masses and masses of material coming towards him. You know, paper material that he had to process. One of his secretaries wrote of him that he drew upon him a multitude of suits, as was incredible, but to us that saw it, for besides all business in council and other weighty causes, there is not a day in a term wherein he received not 30, 40, or 100 different items of paper.
Blimey.
So the idea then is, like, when you're in government like that and you've got that sort of swamp of paperwork coming to you, you know, that are connected with foreign business, domestic affairs, how do you organise it? And this is a time when we see the rise of the private secretary, but also the principal secretary, and we see the development of these very sort of intricate filing systems to be able to keep this all in place. And I've got a really brief quote here from a manuscript manual written in 1592, which was prepared by a secretary, Nicholas Faunt, who's one of Francis Walsingham's, Elizabethan spymaster, one of his secretaries, describing about how you basically organise paperwork for the principal secretary of state. And he writes, "It shall also be convenient to be provided of another secretary for the dispatch of ordinary matters, and chiefly for the continual attendant in the chamber where the papers are, whose particular charge may be to endorse," in other words, to write notes on the back, "endorse them or give them their due titles as they daily come in, and every morning to set them in several bundles for the present use of them." So that's your sort of working paperwork. "And then when they grow to be many, those that have been most dealt in and dispatched to be removed into some sort of chest or place, lest confusion or loss of some of them grow through an exceeding and unnecessary multitude of papers, as hath been seen in that place." As you say, exactly, it's about daily processing of paperwork, sorting it out, and then the archiving of it so that you can retrieve it later on. So for me, the history of the pre-paperclip,
the prehistory of the paperclip
is about the organisation of knowledge. It's about bureaucratic culture. It's about archives. It's about how you organise knowledge and materials. How you organise
and the value
paperwork.
Of that.
Yeah.
So it's why the Secretary of the Navy was paid more than the First Lord of the Admiralty.
Yeah,
that's a great fact.
The secretary is something that we should also do.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm doing the symbolism of the paperclip, which is something different to the function of it. Actually, one thing before I move on to that, one of the things that I thought about when I was just fiddling with my paperclip here is that you know how nice it is to undo a paperclip and then it immediately becomes useless. But it's to do with the what's the kind of the secondary function of the paperclip? What's the unexpected function of the paperclip?
It's a symbol.
What else do you use it for?
Picking locks.
I don't know how to do that. We should try.
As a child, I used to unpick a paperclip like this so that it formed an S.
Oh, yeah.
And pretend that I was Superman.
Ah, very. I could have done that because my name is Sam.
Yeah, Super Sam.
Super Sam. Guys, can you get in touch, please, and tell me what the best unexpected uses of the paperclip are? Because I bet there are some fantastic ones that we don't know about.
It's actually good for an iPhone. For taking out a battery.
Yes.
Yes, or a SIM card.
Contemporary unexpected uses of the paperclip. So, symbolism of the paperclip. Absolutely brilliant. Second World War. Norway.
So tell me about that.
The Nazis invade spring, early summer of 1940. And there are various ways in which the Norwegians display their unhappiness with being under the thumb of the Nazis. The Nazis, to a certain extent, have expected this. So they are dealing with signs and symbols of protest and resistance. And they've had to do this all over the shop. And I would actually love to know, I bet they had this, the Germans were obsessive administrators. I bet they probably had people thinking about this and identifying things which were signs of resistance. Going to look into that. One of the things they weren't allowed to do was to talk about the Norwegian royal family or to have anything symbolically representative of the Norwegian royal family, because that was an obvious way and an expected way by the Nazis that the Norwegians would demonstrate resistance to Nazi rule. So I get the sense they were given a load of things they couldn't do.
Right.
And what they did was they adopted their own. And what was great about that is it went under the Nazi radar for a while until they caught up with it. And they used paperclips, which is really interesting. You know, it's a symbol of connectedness. It's a symbol of unity. It's a symbol of solidarity. It's about people being bound together according to some kind of principle, according to some kind of feeling or policy. And they used a paperclip. They would have paperclips in the kind of the pockets of their jackets. And they'd also...
Would you actually be able to see them?
You'd be able to see the paperclip. Yeah. Let me have a paperclip. I'm going to put it on my clothes. This is a tiny one, but it's very subtle.
I should put one on as well.
And once you put it on, you can see half the paperclip. There we are. So we are now
paperclip game.
We are united in our experience of podcasting about paperclips. So they wore paperclips, and they also started making jewellery out of paperclips, which I think is fascinating. It took the Germans a while to work out what was going on. Part of the reason bound up in this, the fact that it was the Norwegians doing it, is that there was belief that the paperclip, as we know, this gem paperclip, was designed by someone called Johan Valier. But he actually designed a paperclip which was different and was never put into mass production. So it's also a wonderful example of people getting it wrong. They believed it was correct because it was written in Norwegian encyclopedias saying that Johan Valier did actually invent the paperclip, but it's incorrect. Nevertheless, they adopted this as a symbol of national identity and national solidarity. And from there, that got me thinking about symbols of national identity. Particularly in the wake of what's happened in the last year or so. And this, I think, is one of the most important symbols of our time now. Have you seen that?
Yes, that's the Eiffel Tower, sort of like a CND sign.
Yes, it's the world-famous peace symbol, but the fork in the centre is the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
And that was produced by a graphic designer shortly after the Paris bombings of November 2015. It's a sign that immediately says France to you, and it also says peace. Yeah. It's a wonderful piece of graphic design. So now we have these identities and symbols which flash around the world. And this is a new phenomenon. This is something that's only happened in the last 6 months, and certainly in the wake of the Paris attacks. I think that was when it first became noticeable to me. And as well as people putting this symbol all over their Facebooks, all over their Twitters, identifying themselves with the plight of the French, we actually see it on a much broader scale as well, with the Sydney Opera House was coloured with big kind of lasers
right.
in the same colours as the tricolour, as the French flag. So was the London Eye, so was the Brandenburg Gate, so was Christ the Redeemer in Brazil. So there are people now having to find methods of demonstrating symbolically solidarity, and which also cross over boundaries and cross over nations. And so for me, that little paperclip leads us onto all sorts of things. And of course, with everything that we do in the histories of the unexpected, there is an amazing history to it. So this idea of using images like that to talk about French national identity in the aftermath of the 2015 bombings, that's a new thing. Others have histories as well. This one is the most notable one. And everyone who's just watched the Olympics from Brazil, we have a rather gorgeous lady here in a Brazilian samba outfit.
Goodness me, that's incredible. She's
a dancing sunflower.
That's what I was grasping for. Yes, a dancing
Say
sunflower.
Say what you see, James. Yes. Don't panic.
She's a dancing sunflower, yes.
What's that about? I mean, I was thinking as well when I was watching all of the kind of the pre-show for the Olympics and the post-show for the Olympics, what the hell is going on in Brazil? It's the only place it happens.
It's the history of the paperclip.
It's the history of the paperclip. Brazilian samba is the history of the paperclip. It is the key to unlocking what's going on there. I know I only use it as a slightly off-the-wall, ridiculous example, but samba is a key symbol, both the music and the dance, of Brazil, but not only of Brazil, of Rio, the city in particular. And that didn't just come out of nowhere. Mm. It's an early 20th century thing that happened, and it's a phenomenon that appeared, and it's massively complex, and it's all to do with Brazilian music, it's all to do with origins of Brazil, it's all to do with race, and also their passion for culture, and also all to do with extreme political uncertainty, identity within Brazil in the early 20th century. Mm. It's a very disparate nation, politically and culturally, and out of this kind of chaos came samba. And it did unite people, and it is now used as a symbol of Brazilian culture.
So it's a sort of cultural paperclip.
It is a cultural paperclip.
Uniting people. Let me take you back to your symbolism of the Norwegian use of the paperclip. It's very similar to what we see in a post-Brexit landscape where people are wearing safety pins.
Okay.
You know, people were wearing safety pins after all the sort of racist attacks and violence, you know, that was leading up to the Brexit vote and post it. Maybe it's sort of decreased now, but it was certainly something in those few weeks afterwards. You know, people were wandering around with safety pins to say, you know, that effectively we are united. We are not going to let this kind of, you know, xenophobic racist behaviour happen.
Mm. It's cheap.
And it's innocuous. Everyone has them, you know, rather like the sort of, you know, the breast cancer pins yeah. that people would have.
Well, one of the interesting things about the paperclip demonstrations in Nazi Norway was that one of the first mass demonstrations happened at university. It was non-violent and it was cheap. And that links us to the wonderful history of student demonstrations. Doesn't it?
It does, but yeah. We're not going down no, the route. Down. We're not going down okay. the route of student demonstrations, but God. It does.
I went to my first demonstration the other day. I'd never been to one before.
You did?
I was filming in Birmingham.
What were they demonstrating?
They were demonstrating against the Tory conference. The Tory right. Conference was held in Birmingham, and they were... It was really interesting, okay? So
we are going down the route of student demonstrations.
Very briefly. It yes. wasn't students. It was all sorts of people. But it was an anti-austerity march.
Right.
That's what it was advertised by. There were thousands of people there. But it kind of got hijacked by all of the various groups that disliked the Tory government for their various reasons. So rather than it being an anti-austerity march, there were people campaigning for... I don't know. I can probably think of 10 or 15 different things. It was one of the most chaotic, unsolidarity displays of misery and unhappiness with the government I'd ever seen. It was really, really interesting. It was supposed to be about one thing and it wasn't. It was about 20.
Goodness me. So the...
I always assumed that demonstrations were actually quite focused on about one thing.
No.
But really not. That is not the case.
People flock towards it for their own yeah. their own purposes. Historically, that has happened. We should
but
do.
When I was there, it really the power of it was completely lost because it was so fractured.
Yeah. Although the group, the crowd, that's something we should do. The history of the crowd.
But no one seemed to know what they were demonstrating against. So there was one of people shouting against austerity, someone shouting against the NHS, someone shouting about jobs in the north. And in terms of its power, it completely lost it because there was nothing to do with unity there. But that's all to do with the history of leadership and actually someone being able to join these people
galvanise these people.
Mm. Yeah. We've gone way off topic.
We have gone way off topic. I'm bringing us back
very briefly
to paper clips. Before we went off on that tangent, I was connecting to the Norwegian symbolic use of paperclips and talked about the safety pin as a sort of an anti-racism
yes.
badge. And then the use of paperclips by Whitwell Middle School in Tennessee. There was the paperclip project where a teacher had a very good idea of teaching them about the Holocaust and basically got them to go around and collect loads and loads of paperclips because she'd heard that Nazi Germany was being protested against by the Norwegians because of these paperclips and it was all about the Holocaust. I mean, quite incorrect historically, but it certainly meant something to that group of, you know, of school children. But I want to take us on a slightly different tangent, but connected to what we've been talking about. You know, we've been talking about Nazi Germany. I want to talk about Germany post-World War II and the Stasi and the activities of the Stasi, which was filmed in a wonderful film called The Lives of Others. And in East Germany, the Stasi were the Ministry for State Security. And this is a bit like Big Brother. The attempt was to know everything about everyone. This was about a surveillance state. And at its height, the Stasi had something like 90,000 full-time employees, you know, who were basically keeping tabs on people through reading their mail, videoing them, you know, audio, extortion, bribery. I mean, it was absolutely immense. It was these.
Hasn't MI5 been doing this? I mean, reading the paper.
It has.
It's the modern equivalent.
Probably listening to us now as yeah. well as we say this. We have to be careful. But these tentacles of the state that are out there. So this is about bureaucracy. It's about keeping tabs on people.
Mm.
But where I want to go with this is here. Post the Berlin Wall coming down in the 80s, there was a shredding of all evidence.
Wow.
Okay, so what do you describe there? You've got a photograph that I'm showing you.
There's a lady in front of loads of boxes of fragments of paper in a room full of boxes, which I presume are all full of fragments of paper. That's all I can tell you about that. Yep. It looks like someone's dealing with, you know, occasionally they find ancient papyrus manuscripts and they're in a thousand different pieces. It looks like the kind of fragments of that.
This is it. They are puzzles. This is a puzzle woman.
I want to be a puzzle man.
The puzzle man. So basically what this is, post reunification, the government has basically kept employees working in these archives to deal with the requests of German people to see the records of them from the time of the Stasi. And this puzzle woman is basically, what you see here is there are lots of different boxes, as you've said, almost like a jigsaw puzzle. And what she is doing is basically putting the documents back together.
No.
So that people can read them. There have been, apparently, since 1991, almost 3 million requests. They have 5,000 requests each month for people to look at their own files.
See what people have said about them.
To see what people have said about them. Because, you know, these are now public documents. People are interested in what was said about them. What kind of tabs were people keeping on them? What information were they keeping on them? And they're now applying, you know, sophisticated computer algorithms to this. It's not just the puzzle women who are dealing with this. It's computers that are being brought in to sort of piece the material together.
I suspect that's a bigger challenge to the state, sort of observation of that many people, than it is kind of keeping tabs on tax and finance.
Absolutely. It's that kind of state, you know, where people are being observed all the time.
So the history of paperclip is to do with the history of paranoia. And people being right to be paranoid. Everyone, you should be right to be paranoid.
Yeah.
Everyone's watching.
Yeah. Before we go, one final thing is about paperclips and archiving again.
Right.
When you work in the archives, one of the most annoying things for me and one of the most annoying things for archivists is finding rusty paperclips.
Yeah.
Because although we all use paperclips today, you think what happens in 100, 200 years? You know, those paperclips rust, and that rust is passed to the paper, and it damages the paper. So I have here a set of instructions from a pamphlet produced by the Government Standards Agency on Preservation of Archive Professionals, which talks about exactly how you should treat paperclips. Paperclips are a very bad thing. The National Preservation Office, in its pamphlet on basic handling practice, says that pressure tapes, metal or plastic fasteners such as paper clips and pins should never be used and must be removed by trained staff. And they go on to say that, you know, basically you shouldn't really use these. And the best way to keep documents is not to paperclip them, but to have them in acid-free paper folders as enclosures.
So we're in a post-paperclip world?
We're really in a digital world. The real thing is the paperclip is really defunct, and now it's all about keeping your digital data up to date.
With a digital paperclip?
Yeah, so we've gone from the pre-paperclip world...
Prehistory
to
of the paperclip.
The prehistory of the paperclip, to the history of the paperclip, to the post-modern history
of
the paperclip.
Via Norway.
Via student protest and Brazilian dancers.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't even talk about human experimentation.
No.
Which I was going to talk about.
You were?
I'm going to leave that. It's all to do with Operation Paperclip. Everyone, you should go and try and find out about Operation Paperclip. It's absolutely fascinating. It's one of those ridiculously named operations happened in the Second World War.
I shall shuffle my papers now and put my paperclips back in order.
Everyone, do get in touch with us. Tell us about your paperclip histories and come up with ideas for future shows. As always, you are the most important and you are the third member of this podcast. So don't forget us. We want to hear from you. Fantastic. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you enjoy this podcast and you like learning about the past, check out my latest venture. It's called History Masterclass, and it's a new type of historical event where you can actually learn in person from the best historians around today in unique and stunning historical locations. You can find out more at thehistorymasterclass.com and follow on Facebook and
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Twitter @TheHistoryMC.